This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. I'm interviewing consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist, Dr. Matthew Hodes, honorary clinical senior lecturer in child and adolescent psychiatry at Imperial College London. Today we will focus on the mental health of young refugees and asylum seekers. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Matthew, thank you for joining me. Can you start with a brief introduction about who you are and what you do?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jo. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I trained in medicine and psychiatry and then child and adolescent psychiatry in London. Did my training at Maudsley Hospital, and I also studied social anthropology to MSc level in various breaks that I took during that time. And I carried out research at the Maudsley Institute of Psychiatry, as it was then, getting a PhD. Actually, that was in eating disorders, family treatment of eating disorders in adolescence.
My next question is how did you come to be interested in the mental health of young refugees and asylum seekers?
Well, what happened, as I mentioned, I studied social anthropology, so I was always interested in cultural influences on mental health. Then when I got a consultant job in West London in the 1990s, this was a time of the Yugoslavian Civil War, and many refugees came to West London and indeed many other parts of the UK. And I was called to a meeting in a school to address the needs of young Bosnian children. And I realized then that very little was known about them and there was no specific provision. So in my, at that time I was lead clinician for the area, I started to develop outreach services for young refugees in the community. And these services expanded and then I was able to start a number of research projects that were stimulated by that experience. So my work's continued actually since the 1990s. And even though the outreach refugee mental health service closed after about 10 or 12 years, I was able to carry on with a number of research projects and continue to do so.
We know that adult asylum seekers and refugees have elevated rates of PTSD and depression compared to their non-refugee peers. What can you tell us about the impact of psychological distress and psychiatric disorder as it relates to child and young asylum seekers and refugees?
Okay, well, there are a number of parts to that question. Firstly, we need to think about psychological distress and how that arises. Mm-hmm. So psychological distress arises in this group partly because of threat events, fear of persecution or direct aggression, and partly because of loss events, loss of family, loss of community. And then thirdly, I'd add to that, actually, the experience of migration and culture change. And we can think about these three areas in a particular time frame that reflects the life course of refugees. So starting off with their experience, often their home communities, where they may be exposed to organized violence, and then they may be contemplating journeys. When the journeys are carried out, they're very variable in terms of the duration and the level of security or the degree of threat during those migration journeys, often with great hardship. But of course, for some who have support from international agencies, they may be granted refugee status quite early on in their experiences, and that'll make their journeys much more easy often. And after the migration journey, then they will be experiencing resettlement stresses often, and that could be associated with further experiences of loss, and also sometimes further experiences of direct aggression and threat, often because of racism or direct attacks. And we've all seen pictures of attacks on asylum hostels in European countries. So those experiences, understandably, are associated with a lot of changes in emotional state. And that explains the very increased level of psychiatric disorder in the asylum-seeking refugee population. There have been a number of reviews, systematic reviews and meta-analyses looking at the prevalence of psychiatric disorder in children and adolescents. One was published in 2005 and another good one in 2020. And just looking at these two reviews, which I've selected because they both rely on interview-based studies, it's been shown that the prevalence of psychiatric disorder is much elevated. So, for example, the most recent review shows prevalence of PTSD above 20% and depression above 13%, and anxiety disorder also would be elevated. So these are much higher rates than you would find in a comparison group of same age peers. Of course, there have been many other difficulties experienced by asylum-seeking refugee children, depending on their age and maturation. So, for example, problems like bedwetting and clingy behavior, difficulties in separation, typically are not measured in many of these studies, but they are often highly prevalent. And then, of course, there are rarer problems and disorders, which are still very significant amongst those who experience them. So we know that these background adversities and ongoing stresses are associated with elevated rates of hopelessness, suicidality, deliberate self-harm. And also, because of the very high arousal associated with these experiences, there's a high rate of psychosis as well. So even though psychosis was a relatively rare disorder in adolescents, even if we have twice the prevalence of psychosis, it's still a significant increase, even if it's still relatively rarely encountered. But it does mean if you are working in, for example, a specialist psychiatric inpatient unit for adolescents, you know, there may be a higher number of asylum seekers and refugees than one might expect, simply in terms of the numbers.
I wanted to ask you about the impact of COVID-19. And in March 2022, the CAM published your editorial perspective on the mental health of young asylum seekers and refugees in the context of this. What additional burdens has the pandemic posed to child and adolescent asylum seekers and refugees?
Well, firstly, I think that the young asylum seekers and refugees and their families may have had a direct experience of COVID. They may have been less likely to have been vaccinated. So parents in particular may have caught COVID and have been affected. And this will have an impact, of course, on the children for whom they're caring. Of course, the children themselves are less likely to have severe COVID. So the effect of the COVID directly is going to be on the parents and their management of the children, support for the children. But I think far beyond that and much more general impact was the mitigating processes put in place by the government to reduce the prevalence of COVID. So having to stay at home and work from home obviously would have had much bigger impact on those in inadequate, overcrowded accommodation, not only because of, you know, the sort of obvious stressors, but also, of course, that would increase the spread of COVID. And then associated with that time, of course, were school closures. Now, school closures for a lot of children will be very, very stressful. But for asylum seekers, refugees, school actually is a very hopeful and normalizing environment in which they can learn English, develop friendships, and it helps them to become integrated. So the closure of school would have much higher threat and be much more difficult for this group than for many others. Actually, some of these points have been made by Michael Marmot, who is the expert on inequality, writing about the way in which COVID has had a differential impact on people from more deprived backgrounds than from those who are more in more comfortable environments. I suppose the final thing to say is that asylum seekers and refugees may come from very diverse cultural backgrounds with very different understanding of disease, often with experience of distrust in governments and government recommendations. And so they may be less likely to get vaccinated and may require a bit more help in understanding how vaccines can prevent future disease later on.
It ties in with the next question I want to ask you, which is about access to and provision of services and the types of barriers and challenges that affect this group. I mean, we know that for general CAMs and specialist services, there are already long waiting lists. In your CAM editorial, you suggested services are increasingly inadequate for asylum seekers and refugees. Can you say a bit more about this?
Okay, well, the difficulties in access may have been exacerbated by COVID, of course, when services themselves were under strain. But even prior to COVID, there are a number of challenges often for asylum seeking refugees in obtaining appropriate services. Firstly, in some areas, there have been accounts of difficulty in registering with general practitioners. And for many, GPs are the first line of referral to CAMHS. There's another group of young children who are distressed, of course, who will be identified in school settings. And as I said, school is a very important environment for asylum seekers, refugees. Now, as compared to non-asylum seeking or non-refugee peers, they may be more likely to experience internalizing problems, which could mean that they're very quiet, withdrawn, maybe a bit socially anxious. And in combination often with language difficulties, this may make it more difficult for the teachers to recognize significant psychological distress and therefore difficulties which teachers might have picked up for other children who are showing externalizing behavior, which of course attract the attention of very busy teachers. These difficulties may be overlooked. The other thing to say is that some of the difficulties we know are experienced at particular times of the day. So often asylum seeking refugees may experience difficulties at night time when they have nightmares and so on. So sometimes actually the difficulties may be less manifest in the school setting and sometimes more manifest at night. This may be more true for the unaccompanied asylum seeking children who some of them actually living in low support arrangements. So they go home back to a homeless accommodation. And for some of them, their distress will increase at nighttime as they spend more time on their own.
So what should teachers and other adults who come across these children, what kind of clues, if you like, should they be looking for of signs of distress in a child that's perhaps fairly quiet and withdrawn?
Well, it would be very varied. So depending on the age and the language fluency of the children. So younger children, for example, may show preoccupation with traumatic events through their drawings or through the pattern of play. Other children, young children, may show clingy behaviours, difficulty separating from parents. Of course, if it's possible to talk to parents, teachers may get an idea about whether the child in the school setting is very different to how he or she was in the school in the country of origin. That may or may not be possible to find out because of language and other barriers. Then some of the teachers may identify, you know, children who are you know, emotionally distressed, the point of being tearful and so on. Of course, those children who are showing visible signs, it would be easier then for the teacher to identify that they might need help. In fact, teachers who get to know the children usually are pretty good at detecting the difficulties. And sometimes, quite often, they will detect difficulties which are not brought to the attention of the GP.
Let's look at need and best practice. So from your experience as a practitioner and from evidence-based research, what have you learned in terms of need and best practice when it comes to the mental well-being of child and adolescent refugees and asylum seekers?
There's a kind of a long and a short answer to that question. So I'll just try and give a rather succinct answer. So I think the first thing to say is that it's very important with this group to be able to think in terms of multi-level interventions and systems. There may be many agencies involved in helping refugee children and asylum seekers. So liaison with the appropriate agencies, whether it's social care, volunteer organisations, would be important. And alongside that, express support for improved service provision and access may be possible, and the CAMHS clinician may be able to support that. The second thing I'd say is that in clinical work, one's got to be rather pragmatic. And often there are things that you really don't know and it can be hard to find out because of language reasons. Often there are issues of trust, fear of disclosure of what happened. Of course, the migration routes mean that, and the hostility of rising from government policy mean that often people have entered the country in a way that's called illegal. And so that may heighten fear of disclosure or background difficulties. Often one's having to make assessments and do clinical work without full knowledge, and often developmental assessments are not really very complete. The child may have been out of school for many years, for example, and so looking at certain, you know, milestones like reading age or, you know, how old was the child when he or she could read may have very different meaning, may not be possible to ascertain. So the kind of pragmatic approach, and then talking to parents about and the family about what they want and what the child wants. The final thing I think some of the principles of evidence-based practice are still applicable here, but they just have to be adapted to people who may be mobile, be unsettled homes, but if they're adapted, they could be taken up. But I think beyond the specificity of evidence-based practice is the need to communicate hope and warmth and concern to the families. So those non-specific qualities in our relationship are important in this area as well.
So given the challenges that you've described, what advice do you have for CAM professionals working with young refugees and asylum seekers?
Well, if they're new to the field, I think it would be worthwhile just finding out a bit about the background of the asylum seekers or refugees they're going to be working with by reading, by talking to people from those communities, and then talking with people who have carried out this work. I think the kind of pragmatism that I was mentioning is important to bear in mind. The final thing would be that even though we've been talking a lot about adversity and risk and how that may impact on mental health, of course, when we're dealing with very large migrations, if we just take the Ukrainian refugees, so millions of people have left Ukraine now. I know the number of coming to UK is only in the hundreds of thousands, but even with that number, what we have to remember is that some of the children will have developmental difficulties or disorders that they would have had even if they hadn't experienced war. So you shouldn't overlook the fact that some of these neurodevelopmental or other related problems might arise, and they could be a little bit harder to detect because of the difficulty of the child settling in school and the teacher identifying them. So for example, children who are the shy and inhibited, their inhibitor control will be greater. It can take longer time for example, a child with ADHD to present and for the teacher to recognize those difficulties because of, as I say, the emotional state and maybe because of language difficulties. The usual psychiatric and developmental difficulties that we see in all children could still occur in this group. So that's something I'd say. And then just bearing that in mind, it does mean that those difficulties may become apparent over time, even if it's hard to be sure about them at the time of first contact or soon after settlement in the UK or other resettlement countries.
Matthew, you talked earlier about hostile government policies. What socioeconomic interventions are known to support young asylum seekers and refugees? And what is your message to policymakers?
We know that very high levels of homelessness or very low levels of support are associated with more psychological distress and high prevalence of psychiatric disorder. So people are more supported in appropriate refugee centres, and unaccompanied asylum seeking children who are placed what we call high support living arrangements, which could be foster families or high supported hostels for the older adolescents. That's the kind of support that's needed. Longer duration with uncertainty around asylum and refugee status is associated with more distress. At the time when asylum applications are being reviewed causes distress. I think the government policies, many of them actually have been regarded as being illegal. They've been criticised by UNHCR. And many, many court challenges have been made, and often government Home Office decisions have been struck down by courts. And the portrayal of refugees and asylum seekers in much of the press often is very hostile. So, for example, people who arrive across the channel or in the back of lorries or whatever are assumed to be illegal immigrants. And in fact, what's happened is that the access to UK and other resettlement countries has become so restricted that the only way of entering is through those routes. They're called illegal, and in fact, they can't really be illegal without it being ascertained whether they have a legitimate claim. So the government, for example, is communicating in a hostile way, creating a hostile culture. And you know, we've seen this in a very extreme form, of course, with the Windrush generation. But what's happened to asylum seekers and refugees is a continuation of a policy of hostility. So I'd say that the policies should be more benign, more supportive. Restricted accommodation for asylum seekers should be changed, where some people may be making inappropriate or illegal claims. This should be managed in a more humanitarian way.
The theme of Refugee Week 2022, held in June, was healing, defined as recovering from a painful experience or situation so that we can continue to live. Matthew, how optimistic are you that healing is possible for dislocated children and young people?
Well, I'm quite optimistic about that. I think that even though we focused rather a lot on the negatives and the stresses of migration and refugee experiences, in fact, for many, coming to resettlement countries is an opportunity. Whether people can take that opportunity often depends on not only the background adversities, but their personalities, sensitivity to those experiences, family function, family strengths, and the outlook of the families and hopes for the future. So those who have many of the strengths, you know, high family support and a positive outlook may settle and integrate very well. So asylum seeking refugee children typically learn English in about 6 or 8 months when they're attending school full time. So the beginning, of course, is very bewildering for them, but they do very rapidly learn English. And if they're in schools or areas which are multicultural, it may be more easy for them to develop friendship groups. So I think actually many of them will largely recover in terms of achieving good social function. It's not to say they won't have memories of difficult journeys, but living with those memories will become much more easy. And the positives over time may significantly outweigh the pain of the losses and the journeys. Of course, for parents, it may be rather different, because for parents to integrate and adjust may be more difficult because of difficulties in learning English. They may be excluded from the labor market for a long time, unlike their children, of course, are integrated into school. And then obtaining jobs for the parents commensurate with their previous skills and occupational level may be difficult. So often you have a generational difference between how children see settlement as compared to the struggles that may last much longer for the parents, who may then continue to miss their home country much more. Of course, they'll have a much longer memory of their home country community than the children.
Matthew, what else is in the pipeline for you that you'd like to mention?
Well, for me personally, I've just been collaborating with some colleagues from Scandinavia and Ukraine, and we've been looking at a data set of adolescents exposed to the first Russian invasion. This was in 2014 when parts of the Donbass were occupied, and we've just been analysing this data set, comparing in a sample of 2,700 adolescents, the level of war exposure of those in that region as compared to those in neighbouring regions outside of the occupied zones, and looking at risk of psychiatric disorder, PTSD and depression and anxiety. And actually our first paper's in press. It does show 3 times the risk of PTSD in those who are exposed to the war. So this is of interest because these are children who are not displaced. They're not actually refugees. They're just living in the area which is occupied by Russian-supported troops. And of course, with a large sample and so on, there's some methodological strengths. And there'll be a couple of other papers coming from that data set. The other thing, actually, because of the Ukrainian crisis, I've been asked to write a short article for the journal Clinical Child Psychology and Psychiatry, which I'm just about to finish and hopefully will be accepted. And there are various other projects that I'm working on in the field still.
Finally, Matthew, what is your take-home message for those listening to our conversation?
My take-home message would be that asylum seekers and refugees are people who need support but can also offer a lot. And we need to think in a positive way about what they can bring and communicate hope to them. And bear in mind that, of course, despite the challenges, some of which we've been discussing, most will be psychiatrically well, but the small group may need additional help, but that a practical and pragmatic response to their difficulties may go a long way, even though sometimes we're not always quite sure how what we've offered has helped them because of mobility reasons. You know, they may be moving location, sometimes language issues and so on. Sometimes it's a little bit hard to know exactly how much we've helped. But I think on balance, what we're offering is highly appreciated, where we can mobilise services to help them.
Brilliant. Matthew, thank you so much. So it's a message of hope. For more details on Dr. Matthew Hodes, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.